Accession number 3997, Reel 2.
Colonel Reddy, Reel 2. Could we turn to recruitment of Sudanese? How did this take place?
One of the delights of serving in the Sudan Defense Force was the fact that there was no shortage of recruits. It was a great honor to be enlisted as a soldier. And when a soldier went back to his village on leave, he was regarded as a very important person. So one was able to pick and choose more or less as one liked to make sure one got not only the more intelligent, but also the fittest recruits.
Did you send out recruiting parties, or was this unnecessary?
Really, it was unnecessary to send out any recruiting parties. I think what usually happened was when soldiers went on leave, they were told if there were going to be any vacancies, and they were invited to bring their pals back with them. And in that way, one acquired a very happy sort of unit. They were happy to work with each other.
Did these soldiers wear their uniform on leave?
Most of the soldiers discarded their uniform on leave. They went back to their normal native galabeer, a white sort of nightshirt. Except for those from the Nuba Mountains who discarded their clothes altogether and went back to nature, as they'd always been accustomed to.
Did you have a policy in your corps, the Camel Corps, with respect to recruitment? Were there any tribes from whom you did not recruit?
Yes, I suppose there was a policy that one never had. One probably put all the same tribe in one company. In fact, in the Camel Corps, we had two Nuba companies and three Arab companies. And again, there were different tribes in each of those companies. The Camel companies had tribes from the northern part of Kordofan, which was the camel-owning part of the country. And the Mounted Infantry Company were manned by another tribe who lived nearer the river. They were more accustomed to riding horses and therefore obviously were much better looking after them.
And can you remember anything about their pay?
I really can't remember how much pay they used to get. Payday was held once a week, and the native officer always did the payout. The soldier had to mark the pay list with his thumb because most of them couldn't write. But I've really no idea exactly what they received. But they were responsible for providing their own rations, except on active service. And so no doubt the pay was sufficient to enable them to do that.
Did they live with their families?
And they lived with their families in what were known as the Harrimat lines. These were rows and rows of identical. We called them tukuls. In other parts of Africa, they called them rondavels or round houses. They are made of mud and wattle with grass roofs.
And did they make them themselves?
They used to build their houses themselves, and every year they had to be replastered. The walls were plastered with a mixture of dung and sand, which withstood most of the weather.
What happened to the children during the day?
Each company ran its own school, and the it was a very simple affair. It was just an open shelter, a grass roof shelter, and the children would go there and learn their lessons.
Who were they taught by?
They were taught by a local, probably a local religious man, a sheikh of some sort, but probably more of a religious type.
And they learned to read and write at these little schools, did they?
I don't think they did much writing. It was mostly reciting. But they did do writing. They had slates on which to write. They didn't use paper in those days.
And did any of the soldiers go along, as well as their children? Or was this just purely for
the
children?
No, this was only for the children.
Did the soldiers receive any other form of training or education in addition to basic training?
I don't think so. I don't recall that any special schools were arranged for. I don't think adult education, as we call it today, was even thought of.
What about first aid? Did they learn any first aid?
Oh, yes. We did teach them the elementary first aid. And this became a more important subject when the war came, the last war came. But it was always in the curriculum.
And who would teach them this?
Oh, each company had its own Temurgi. He was the medical orderly, and he would be responsible for that. He was a trained medical orderly.
And what was his background usually? Was he Sudanese?
He would be Sudanese. He probably had been to a primary school and possibly a secondary school, and therefore had a better education.
And yourself, did you learn any first aid? Any additional skills, shall we say?
No, I won't say that I did any particular first aid course. Oh. I've done a good many courses in the army, but I don't think that was one of them.
And the religious observances of the corps followed the Muslim pattern?
Yes, Friday was the holiday in the week.
What did the soldiers tend to do on a Friday?
I suppose they did their household chores and their washing and that sort of thing, and a certain amount of praying too, the right time of day.
Were there any other observances which the army permitted? How did they deal with Ramadan, for instance?
Ramadan just had to be accepted.
What tended to happen?
Preferably, one tried to arrange a safari at that time to get them away from their homes, because then it was much more possible to do some work. I think in the station, it was inevitable that parades had to be relaxed to a certain extent to allow for it because of their custom.
Did you find them less easy to control, less amenable to discipline during Ramadan?
I don't know that they were less amenable to discipline, but they were just so dopey by the time they had their feast all night, which they do, and they really weren't worth much during the day.
But I gather from what you just said, therefore, that if they were away from camp, therefore religious observances went by the by.
Yes, yes, they didn't expect that one recognised religious observances at all once one was on safari, because the whole attitude was that every unit should be ready to move at a moment's notice. And once one got the order to go out on trek, it was all ready in 24 hours and off they went. All the necessary stores were kept separate for this occasion, and they merely got out of the store and put onto the camels or into the cars, and off we went.
Yes. Were there any observances which the army would not permit, even in camp?
No, I don't think I recall any particular observances that we'd just didn't seem to crop up, I don't think.
Did they see their Hurley men frequently, or were they tended to keeping away from camp?
Well, my most recollection of that is when one was teaching to shoot on the range, and you would find a chap was frequently missing the target. And one would send him off to see his holy man, and he'd come back the next day and he'd get a bullseye every time.
Why was this?
Well, I suppose he got his confidence back, and he was a much better shot the next day.
Did this happen very often?
Well, not very often, but there were some soldiers, after one had done everything possible to try and encourage them to hit the target, and nothing would do any good. You sort of just set them off. You go and see your holy man.
They didn't actually have any objection to shooting as such.
Oh, no.
No, confidence.
I think it's a matter of confidence.
Mm. On the question of rations, when they were out trekking, they had rations. And what sort of rations would these be?
Oh, the soldiers would carry their bag of flour and dried lentils or beans of some sort. And they'd make it up into a sort of mess of pottage, I think is sort of the easiest way to explain it, in a bowl. They'd probably, a platoon would put all their bits of their own individual rations into it and make one bowlful, and then they'd all just dig out of it.
And did they drink at all?
Not alcohol on trek, no.
What did they drink?
Oh, just water. Ah. One always carried an adequate supply of water, or with a mounted company, of course, one moved from one water point to the next.
As to discipline, how amenable were they to discipline? Did they need it?
Well, I think they were no worse than British soldiers as far as discipline is concerned. Probably their crimes were rather different. They would at certain times they would be celebrating probably in their own with their own families and drink to excess. Otherwise the crimes were late for parade or dirty equipment or not complying with orders. The usual sort of things that will happen in any service unit. There was a scale of punishment, and lashes were awarded for the most severe crimes.
What would they be?
Probably theft, mainly, or continual drunkenness, and incapable of doing their job.
And how did the process of corporal punishment take place?
Well, it was a normal sort of routine ceremony. The company would be formed up in three sides of a square, and the offender would lie face down on the ground with a wet cloth placed across his backside, and the company sergeant major would administer the lashes with a rhinoceros whip. I suppose the average award would be 10 lashes. But one must remember that this sounds a very savage form of punishment, but in their eyes it wasn't the same at all, because amongst themselves, in order to show their virility and their manliness to their lady friends, they were accustomed to thrash each other across the back with these rhinoceros hide whips until their backs were absolutely raw with wheels sometimes. And the man who could take it was obviously the chap of the tribe.
What other powers of discipline did you yourself have? Could you dismiss men from the army, for instance?
Yes, there were means of getting rid of bad hats who were permanently in trouble. But I don't recall that this happened very often because, as I say, we had such enormous number of recruits to choose from that one just didn't seem to get a bad one very often.
Was there much competition for promotion amongst them?
Yes, I would say there was, yes. The brighter boys who probably had rather more schooling than some of the others were the ones who would be most interested in getting promotion. They're very, very keen soldiers, isn't it?
And did they have to be able to read and write to be able to be promoted?
I would say so, yes. They had to be able to write, yes. And read Arabic, of course.
Yes. As to the native officers, do you remember their range of duties and if it differed in any way from a British equivalent?
I think that the duties of the native officers were very much the same as in the British Army. They actually carried out the training. The British officer was really to ensure that to make the plan for the training, the decide on the program in accordance with the wishes of his corps commander, and to see that the native officers carried them out. Mm-hmm. But the actual teaching was basically done by the native officers.
Were they accorded the same respect, do you think, that the British officers were accorded?
Oh, yes, very much so. Yes, they lived entirely apart from the soldiers, and they fed apart from them, and they behaved in every way as officers should.
They had the same standard of accommodation and food as yourself?
No, I wouldn't say their houses were as elaborate as ours. No, definitely not. The very senior ones might, but most of them would live in. They'd probably live in a brick or wooden house rather than a mud house.
With their wife and family?
Yes, yes.
And what was the highest rank that the native officers would expect to reach?
That would be of this word Saglio Gashi, which was the equivalent of an adjutant major. He wasn't quite a major. He was halfway between a captain and a major, really, but he wore one crown. But there were comparatively few of those. I think there was only one per corps.
Do you think more of them could have been given more responsibility, or had they reached their own level of
Well, I think events efficiency. Proved that once the Sudan Defense Force handed over to the Sudan Army, The Sudanese officers were perfectly capable of running the units themselves. Yes, I think they were very efficient, and I think much the same thing happened in the Indian Army too. And they still follow the traditions which they've learned from the British Army.
Right. Turning now to your own duties over the period. You were first of all a staff officer in Camel Corps headquarters. Where was this?
I joined the Camel Corps at the headquarters at El Obeid, and they had certain outstations, two in the Nuba Mountains and one in Bara, which was one of the camel companies were stationed.
And what were your duties in your 6 months at headquarters first?
Well, I was really the assistant to the corps commander, and he took me round with him on visiting the different companies, which made me a very good opportunity to see how they worked. I helped him to plan the core exercises, which used to take place every year.
What sort of exercises
would
these?
That would mean that all the companies would be congregated together and the exercises were carried out with firing live ammunition because there were plenty of desert areas where one could do this without any problems. It was usually to capture a hill or some particular valley or some bridge or something like that. These sort of exercises were sort of similar to the manoeuvres which the British Army are accustomed to hold.
Yes. And how often were these exercises
taken? This was an annual event to get all the companies together.
Yes.
Other times of the year, the companies would be sent out on flag-showing expeditions so that over a number of years the whole of their particular province was covered.
Can you describe the overall terrain of the Camel Corps?
Basically, the country was desert with thorn trees, except in the southwest, which is an area known as the Nuba Mountains, where the pagan chaps live who don't normally wear any clothes. And there the vegetation was much more luxurious, there was more water, more rainfall. At the same time, the climate was inclined to be rather damp at certain times of year, not quite so healthy.
You learned Arabic at this time, I presume?
Yes, the first thing a British officer had to do was to learn Arabic. There were a certain number of Arabic grammar books which one could use, and one usually employed a company translator. Each company had a clerk who was English speaking, and he would instruct or help the British officer with his Arabic.
How long did it take you to achieve a reasonable fluency?
I think because one was amongst people speaking the language every day, one could get by fairly well in about 3 months. Probably not very grammatically, but one had to take the Sudan Fence Force British Officers exam in the first year, the oral part of it, and the written part in the second year.
And did most people pass this?
The oral, yes. The written was more difficult. But if you missed it one time, well, you had to have another go. Do it again.
And after that, after about 6 months, you went to number 2 company in Barra.
That's right. I was supposed to do to one of the camel companies.
Yes. And what were your duties here?
I actually took over the command of the company when the company commander went on leave. Spent half the time with normal training parades in the station and half the time on trek in the northern part of the Sudan.
Mm-hmm. What happened when you went out on trek? How long would each trek be?
The trek would probably vary from probably 2 weeks to a month, depending on how far one had to go. About every 2 years, one of the camel companies used to go up to the northern border of the Sudan to the Oinat Oasis, where it joins with Libya, but I didn't actually go on one of those expeditions.
Mm. Am I right in thinking that you had to train the camels as well as the men?
Oh, yes, that is so. The camel is a more obedient animal than you would think, really. because the words of command of a camel company on parade were given by a bugle. And as long as the chap leading the riding the leading camel knew what to do and made his camel turn the right direction, all the other camels would follow.
Did it take you time to adapt to working with camels? It must differ from working with horses.
Well, yes, because it's rather a different technique looking after them. They are very prone to all sorts of foul sores and diseases, and they have to be very carefully watched and groomed every day they're in station. In fact, and when they're out too, country, of course, is infested with ticks, which the camels pick up, particularly when they're grazing. And every evening when the camels come in from grazing, the first operation is to form them up in a square, and each soldier with his own camel then has to remove the ticks. In the center of the square, a small fire is made of the camel dung. And he gets a handful of ticks and runs and puts them into the fire, and then he goes back to the camel and collects another handful. And this goes on for half an hour.
How many camels were there in the company?
I think there were 150 in the company. Mm-hmm. I'm generally not quite sure about that.
Mm. And did you become quite knowledgeable about the habits of the camel by the end, or were you always deferring to the experts, who presumably were in immediate charge?
Well, one relied very much on the soldiers, because they were all camel experts. They'd come from camel-owning tribes, and they'd lived with camels all their lives.
And you rode camel yourself?
Yes. The British officer had one riding camel for himself, one for his orderly, one for his batman, and one for his cook, and one for his baggage, which included a tent. And 5-gallon water containers as well.
Was it a comfortable form of travel?
The camel is extremely uncomfortable when it's walking, but if you get a good trotting camel, it's a very comfortable ride. And the camel will go on trotting for half an hour or more non-stop once you get him to that gear.